You have to be optimistic to think that you can change the world. And people will always call you naive, but it's this hope and this optimism that is behind every important step forward. Our lives are connected. And whether we're welcoming a refugee fleeing war or an immigrant seeking new opportunity, whether we're coming together to fight global disease like Ebola or to address climate change, I hope that we have the courage to see that the path forward is to bring people together, not push people apart.
Mark Zuckerberg maybe isn't quite as optimistic these days. He released a long Facebook post today in response to the controversy surrounding Cambridge Analytica, which allegedly used Facebook user data for political purposes. He wrote, in part, "We have a responsibility to protect your data, and if we can't, then we don't deserve to serve you." We'll have more on that story in a moment. But first, California's biggest storm of the season is here. It's an atmospheric river of tropical moisture expected to last through Thursday, possibly Friday, potentially devastating regions with flash floods and mudslides. Evacuations are underway in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties, communities that were ravaged 4 months ago by the Thomas Fire. KCRW's Jonathan Bastian is in Santa Barbara. He's joining us now to talk about what to expect. Hello.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, how have emergency officials been preparing for this storm?
It's been an absolutely massive process that's been going on for months now. And I mean, the key part about this is they've been clearing out those creeks that didn't even look like creeks. You'd have to kind of go find them because they were so caked with mud. They were so filled in. They've also been clearing out debris basins. These are areas that are supposed to kind of catch some of the debris as it comes off of the mountains. So basically doing everything possible to keep this water moving so it can eventually reach the ocean and not spill over, you know, the side of the creeks onto roads, onto property, which is what happened on January 9th. They've also been doing something that's kind of interesting. They're installing these rain gauges, which are kind of what they sound like. They basically measure the amount of rain that's coming in. They've installed them up on some of the mountaintops, also out of the islands. And I took a tour to kind of see what this was all about. And I met John Fry. He's with the Santa Barbara Flood Control. And he told me why they're so important. And let's take a listen.
The gauges will, in fact, allow us to monitor developing conditions, especially the three gauges that are out at the islands, because that will give everybody that monitors this data, including the National Weather Service, a heads up to incoming storms.
Yeah, and we really need a heads up as much as we can considering January 9th. So as of now, these are helpful, again, in terms of collecting data and just letting us know that we could see a lot of rain that could hit this Thomas Fire burn scar area.
Right. So you mentioned January 9th. That's when those devastating mudslides occurred. And some people were not warned to get out, and maybe they should have been warned or they should have gotten out. Has that warning system gotten better?
It's gotten a lot better. I mean, a couple things have gotten better. The mapping has gotten better. I mean, the maps that came out January 9th were so incredibly vague. You didn't even know where you were supposed to be or who was a danger. They were also improperly mapped. They didn't take into account creek beds and kind of the lower line areas. They've also overhauled the system in terms of how we talk about evacuations. It used to just be a voluntary or a mandatory evacuation order. Now we have, it's kind of a three-part system. It goes pre-evacuation advisory, then a recommended evacuation warning, then a mandatory evacuation order. And these all go out about 72 hours in advance of the storm. And they seem to be helping. People kind of have a better sense of when the storm is coming and when they need to be out. And from what we can tell, people are heeding these warnings for the most part.
And where are the high-risk areas?
It's incredible. I mean, this storm is basically, if you look at radar models, it's just like a heat-sinking missile heading towards Santa Barbara. And the big areas we're looking at are the places that were torched by the Thomas Fire. In particular, Montecito, where we had all that flooding. We're also looking at Carpinteria. All those places where a lot of folks live right up against those steep hillsides. Ojai is also another place of concern as well. And so we'll see how it plays out.
So what's the sense that officials have? Is it safer now or not since January 9th?
Yeah, you get a lot of different answers on this. On one hand, after the Thomas Fire, you had all this ash up on the hillside. And what happens when you have ash on the hillside is that it essentially makes the hillsides actually kind of slippery. The rain just hits it and gets debris and starts tumbling down the mountain. It doesn't actually absorb into the ground. So the good news is a lot of that ash has kind of cleared out at this point. But on the other hand, the problem is the storm on January 9th was so powerful that it actually began to dislodge a lot of other debris that's still up in the mountains. I mean, the mountains above Santa Barbara are basically just debris, and it's just waiting to come down here. So, again, I spoke to John Fry, and he kind of also told me a little bit about what that situation's like, and he told me this.
You can look at the creek banks here, and there's just big rock there that's just primed. If we get a flow event that is able to move that stuff, that's the risk that we're going to be facing in this community for the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, and 3 to 5 years gives you a sense of the longevity of this whole thing. I mean, we're not out of this by any means yet, and the thought that there's a lot of this loose stuff up there has a lot of people on edge.
I can imagine. Okay, and so where can they get the latest information?
If you're in Santa Barbara, the easiest thing is to go to readysbc.org. And I got to hand it to them. I mean, they've done actually a pretty good job updating these websites so they're clear. You can see those maps. You can understand the evacuation orders. If you're in Ventura County, I think it's vcemergency.com. They're doing a good job keeping people up to date.
All right, Jonathan, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
That's Jonathan Bastian. He is host and reporter for KCRW Santa Barbara. Coming up, is it time to regulate Facebook? And how accurate are the psychological portraits Cambridge Analytica used to predict voter behavior? We'll find out next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg spoke out today on the news around Cambridge Analytica. That's the British firm that reportedly collected data from at least 50 million people through an app on Facebook. They used it to build voter profiles ahead of the 2016 election. Zuckerberg wrote that his company will work toward protecting user data and investigate all apps with access to Facebook. What's missing is exactly how and when the tech giant will accomplish this. Well, journalist and author Anand Giridharadas tweeted yesterday that Mark Zuckerberg will go down in history as a tragic figure and one befitting an age of billionaire savior delusions. He claimed to change the world even as he maimed his country. Anand Giridharadas is the author of the forthcoming book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so how do you see him as a tragic figure? I think maybe some people would take exception with that term because they see the definition as someone who starts out as a virtuous hero who is then undercut by himself and ends in his own downfall. Do you see him initially as a virtuous character?
I see him as a character who wanted to probably do a good thing, who was perhaps a socially awkward person who thought that he could invent a technology that would allow people like himself and others to be connected. And let's be fair, he has done that. And the tragic part of the tragic hero is when he is so blinded by the idea of himself as a man changing the world, an idea that permeates our culture and saturates the minds of many billionaires and rich and powerful people like him. That's the beginning of the downfall, because it blinds you to the ways in which the story breaks down and you perhaps sometimes become part of the problem.
But I wonder if the savior idea comes after, the initial impetus for him and others is, I want to make a buck. And then realizing this huge platform and this huge service that has, in fact, done a lot of good, as you say, and connected people, then the idea that what they're doing is to benefit humankind becomes the narrative.
I think that's often the case. I think in a way it doesn't matter. I think there are some people who just want to make money and find some kind of startup to do that. I think the idea that business people try to build businesses and make money is not problematic on its own. It becomes problematic when we, the rest of us, start to believe the story that these people tell, that they are change agents. They're not just business people, but they're experts in education, which Mark Zuckerberg purported to be and which many people accepted. When we start to lose faith in our power as a public to solve the problems of the public and we outsource the job of change to billionaires, we start to ask them to do something that regular, normal, self-interested people simply cannot do.
And you argue that Mark Zuckerberg is the private sector left-leaning version of Donald Trump. How so?
I mean, I think, look, these are, by my estimation, these are men of, you know, very different levels of character. I'm not a Zuckerberg fan, but I do not think he's a Donald Trump in his, you know, depravity and vulgarity and complete ignorance and disrespect for the rule of law. That said, I think both of them are what you get when, as a culture, you start to believe in the idea of billionaires as saviors. And that belief has a few components. It, first of all, requires the culture to believe that billionaires are somehow specially incorruptible. Against all evidence of how they might have made their money and how ruthless they might have had to be to make their money, we have this idea, Donald Trump, you know, I don't need money, therefore I'm the freest person in the world to speak the truth. And you have this kind of idea in Zuckerberg of the hoodie, and he's this kind of rich guy who, you know, he genuinely just wants to do good. He genuinely wants to build community. He wants to beam the internet to Africa. And by the way, you see this when there's a clamor for Mike Bloomberg to be the president, and when, you know, the Democrats go wild for the idea of Oprah. This is way broader than Donald Trump or Mark Zuckerberg. This is a tendency in our culture to regard these kinds of people who we should actually be extremely wary and skeptical of, because in a democracy, the concentration of power has always been dangerous. This culture instead makes us kind of think of them as our little daddies.
Well, okay, so taking Facebook as your example, do you think that there is a way to put this, you know, rabbit back in the box, so to speak?
Anybody who has ever bought a blanket and seen that label on the blanket that, you know, you're not allowed to cut off understands that the government, you know, as much as it is fashionable to deplore it and condemn it and say it doesn't work, actually does a pretty remarkable unsung job of watching over all of the products and services in our lives. If you've ever put your kid in a car seat, if you've ever driven a car, if you've ever driven on a road, if you've ever sent your child to a school, public or private, if you've ever lived in an apartment that you can just take for granted doesn't have lead all over it, you have partaken in and benefited from the government just looking out for you, making sure that self-interested people out for a buck can't have their way with you. They can make their buck, but they can't put lead in your house or have your car seat be too easily collapsible. And so those of us who think Facebook is too powerful, we're not calling for anything super strange. We're actually calling for the normalization of Facebook and the acceptance that you're not a startup anymore. You've grown up. You've become a big company. Now act like it.
Mm. So regulation, so that the government would say, you, Facebook, cannot, you know, sell user data without certain restrictions, for example, or you can't sell user data at all. That would go at the
Madeline,
heart of
do
this.
You know if your data was part of the Cambridge Analytica?
I do not.
Do you think you have the right to know that?
I do. Yes.
And do you have a way of finding out right now?
No.
And the company on its own is not going
to
answer your need.
So we need
that's what government is for. We sometimes need to actually remind people what government is for. Government is, we've adopted as secondhand smoke this story that, you know, government's this person banging down your door. Government is just a kind of union that advocates for the citizens of the United States. And it fights for us to do what we can't achieve alone. You can't on your own, despite being a very successful radio host, get Facebook to give you the data you want. But maybe the government of the United States, acting on your behalf and the behalf of tens of millions of other people, would have the leverage to do that. That's all I'm
right.
talking about.
I mean, but what you're talking about is something much broader than just Facebook. I mean, there's been an assault on the government and government regulation since the 80s.
And absolutely.
So this is kind of a much bigger project. But when it comes to Facebook, if there were government regulations in terms of them using or selling us, the customers, because we are the product, wouldn't that just cut to the heart of their entire business model?
That's their problem.
But what do you see as the end result, do you think?
You know, I don't owe Facebook a business model. I've already given Facebook plenty with my world-class photography that I upload every now and then, and, you know, my stupid updates about things and the silly articles I post. We are all contributors to Facebook. We're all giving Facebook free stuff. Facebook's built a pretty great business without compensating any of us for our work product. And if being regulated the way car seats and schools and restaurants and banks are regulated, unfortunately, chips away at their money. It's a kind of sorry, not sorry situation.
I kind of can see one eventual outcome of that as a two-tiered system, whereas if you're rich enough, you can pay for the toll road access and you can pay to have your information private. And then other people who don't want to pay or can't pay have to submit to this or have to have their information.
That's what would happen if we didn't have, you know, a government protecting us. And by the way, this is not, as you say, it's not only about Facebook. This is partly about how we understand the new founts of power in our age. They just happen to be heavily concentrated in Silicon Valley. And every generation faces new sources of power and types of power that sort of scramble their understanding of how the world works. They're, you know, at some point, most companies are pretty localized, and you started to have these very big national companies in the late 19th, early 20th century. That was a challenging. How do you regulate companies like that? You know, and it all seems so impossible, and there's always this throwing your hands up. Well, yeah, we're going to just expand government. Well, the reality is you have to have a kind of competence in the public sector to match what is going on in the private sector. The government has to go where human activity is. And today, human activity is online. People are living their lives online and are being influenced politically online. And these companies all live in this Silicon Valley kind of bro fantasy of being left alone in the basement to tinker by themselves and, you know, not have their mom knock on the door. And the reality is they need to understand that was a long time ago. They've grown up. They are now billionaires, some of the most powerful people on earth. They potentially have the power to tip elections, including in the most robust democracy in human history. They need to grow up and understand and own their power. There is no virtue in pretending you do not have the power you possess. That's not humility. That's actually just a kind of crude form of power grabbing.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that people care? An informal poll of my work space here. And many of the younger people were like, you know what? I know that they use my information. I don't really care.
I think that there's probably a lot to that. There have been articles about the fact that much, much younger people, we're talking about people in their late teens and early 20s right now, I've heard many of them do not use Facebook at all and have, you know, much Instagram, you know, which is, of course, part of Facebook, has been ascendant. So I think in some ways, we already see culturally Facebook becoming a little bit of an old person's platform. I think it's the early days of that. But frankly, I'm not sure that it has, which is why they've bought WhatsApp and they've bought Instagram and all these other things that could be ascendant.
But aren't they doing the same thing, these platforms younger people are using, Snapchat, Instagram?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, your informal poll points to something very important, which is you only get the society you're willing to fight for. You only are going to get tech sector that we are willing to put things on the line for. And if we continue to believe that you can outsource the changing of the world to the Mark Zuckerbergs, if we continue to fall prey to their notion that they are selflessly acting on behalf of humankind's needs, then frankly, we deserve to be ruled. If, on the other hand, we are able to take back our societies from these kinds of billionaire savior posers, whether it's Donald Trump or Mark Zuckerberg, and actually act politically to shape a new age of reform as people did 100 years ago when a new economy required new responses, I think we have a shot at actually building a world that works for many more of us than it presently is.
Anand, great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Anand Giridharadas, he's the author of the forthcoming book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. It's out in August, but can be pre-ordered now. Well, we know that Cambridge Analytica gathered data on millions of Facebook users, and they use that data to develop something called psychographic profiling. It's a strategy that uses people's Facebook likes and their friends' likes to find out the most effective ways to target them. in a sense, to target them when they're at their most vulnerable. Good marketing for sure, a little Big Brother maybe, but does it actually work when it comes to predicting how people will behave in the voting booth? Jonathan Taplin is here to explain all of this. He's the Director Emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at USC. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Okay, so we've known for a long time that Facebook and other social media platforms gather information about us, where we shop, what we do on the weekends, whom we're friends with. So does this, gathering all this information and more, does it actually work to sell us stuff?
Certainly a lot of people believe that. I mean, that's why obviously Facebook's revenues have skyrocketed. The people at Cambridge Analytica and some other people have this notion of what they call an OCEAN profile, which stands for open, conscientious, extroverted, agreeable, and neurotic. And so they believe that they can tell you whether you're the most neurotic or the least neurotic based on what programs you like or what music you listen to or what stuff you shop for. In terms of designing these posts that they would push out for the Trump campaign, they believe that this really worked.
What would tell someone if a user is neurotic? Like, what would be an indicator?
You know, I mean, they think people like the Smiths are neurotic.
But how accurate is that? I mean, maybe you just like the Smiths.
They believe that it's pretty accurate and that, you know, if you watch SportsCenter, you're very unneurotic.
As my producer has pointed out, there is a large contingent of Latinos here in Los Angeles who love the Smiths. Are they all neurotic?
Maybe.
I mean, but that just illustrates the kind of cultural assumptions and the kind of broad-based assumptions in this kind of profiling, right? That it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily take in an individual's many, many vagaries and many personality traits.
I agree. But they believe that if they have 100 likes from you, that they can figure out how you fit on this OCEAN profile. Now, look, I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying that companies like Cambridge Analytica have been able to sell this to Donald Trump or the NRA or, you know, many organizations for a lot of money to tell them that they could help excite you at the exact right point because they know that you're, you know, very unagreeable because you hate, you know, immigrants, and that they can hit you with the right post that kind of mirrors what you already feel and but shows you that Donald Trump feels exactly like you feel. Or on the opposite extreme, if you are a young black man in Detroit who is talking about going out to vote, they could send you a dark post that says Hillary Clinton thinks that all young black men are super predators, and then maybe you wouldn't vote, which was a big part of their strategy, which was essentially virtual voter suppression.
Hmm. But you wouldn't need to know detailed stuff about someone to target them with that kind of an advertisement. You would just need to know if that person is African American. So where does the detailed understanding play
in? Well, the detailed understanding on the other side was, how can you get people who are angry more stirred up and maybe get them to go to a Trump rally?
And so then you would have to know more granular information about
exactly
what gets you agitated online.
Exactly.
And what gets you to click like or...
Exactly.
But no one has really been able to assess whether or not that was effective.
No. I mean, certainly, you know, Brad Parscale, the guy who directed Trump's campaign, said that Facebook was the key to their winning.
But they dropped Cambridge Analytica. They said it wasn't.
Yeah, but
working.
He said that Facebook was the key to their winning. You know, there's a great Channel 4 documentary of inside the Trump data headquarters, and the woman who was running it said that Cambridge Analytica was a very critical part of it. Now, subsequently, Brad Parscale has said, oh, they had nothing to do with it, but I don't believe that.
So are you alarmed by this, having studied this for a while?
I mean, I've been worried about the effect and the ability to put us into our little filter bubbles and balkanize the world for quite a long time. And I think it's getting worse, not better. And I also think that we're not, as we saw from the Marjorie Stoneman shooting incident, none of this is going away. You know, whether it's Russia or it's Gateway Pundit, they've been very good at knowing how to use the algorithms and what buttons to push and how to use bots to amplify propaganda streams.
What do you say to people who say, you know what, it doesn't really bother me. I'm okay with it. I like the convenience. I like the fact that sometimes I get targeted by companies that are selling me stuff that I want. I fully understand that I have given away a lot of my privacy and my personal information. And you know what? That's okay.
When the Bush administration wanted to find out information on 120 million people, where did they go? They went to Google. And Google said, come on in.
I know, but I guess people here, I it's hard to get excited about that when you think, well, you know, nothing bad has happened to me. They already have all my data. It's too late. I mean, what am I going to do? I might as well just, you know, enjoy the easy access to the pair of boots that I want.
Okay, but if that was true, why are there so many people using ad blockers?
Because they're annoying. Pop-up ads are annoying.
If people don't care, they wouldn't be adopting ad blockers.
Well, I don't think it's because they're afraid of their privacy. They're just annoyed by the ads.
Well, that's part and parcel. You're annoyed by the ads because they're chasing you around because they think they know something about you.
And they do.
and if you had any idea of how much data they have on you, you would probably be shocked. I heard of some woman on Tinder who sued them to get all the data they had, and they printed it out. It was like 170 pages. It was just damn Tinder.
Hmm. Yeah, you can go on Facebook. It's a difficult thing, but we did it this morning in our editorial meeting where you can go on Facebook and figure out what your profile is, how they see you. And it's instructive to see how they see you.
Right.
And you can delete that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the Europeans have the right idea. Why shouldn't I be able to use Facebook and not give them all my data? Why couldn't I use the search engine Google and not have them have everything that I ever searched for?
Well, then you'd have to pay for it, right? I mean, nothing's for free.
Well, you might have to pay a little bit, but it wouldn't be much.
Yeah.
I mean, Roger McNamee thinks that that's the way these companies are all going to have to go anyway.
That we'll have to pay to use them.
Yeah. But if you had to pay a buck a month for Google, you'd probably do it.
So are you going to delete your Facebook account?
I've deleted it on all my mobile devices. I still have a desktop account just because I have a book out and I use it to publicize.
See? Everyone wants something. Everyone wants to sell something.
It's true.
You see, now I think your book is going to follow me around the internet.
Good. Maybe you'll buy it.
Jonathan Taplin, he's Director Emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at USC. Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook and Google Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy is the name of his book. Go buy it. Or it'll follow you around the internet.
On Amazon. Thank
Find
you.
It on Facebook, whatever. Thanks, Jonathan.
Bye.
Coming up, the private side of playwright Arthur Miller and what becoming famous did to him and his family.
You begin to shift and change if you're not careful, which I wasn't. People now were talking to me differently. Women, men, they were looking at me like an icon of some kind.
Arthur Miller's daughter, Rebecca, has made a documentary about her dad. She's here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Imagine if we knew the truth.
That's a very lovely thought.
That would be a great thing, and once, sometimes in a lifetime, a playwright can get at it, really.
That's Arthur Miller, one of America's greatest playwrights. All My Sons, Deaf as Salesman, The Crucible. In dozens of plays and radio plays and movies, he did try to get at the truth. His daughter, filmmaker Rebecca Miller, has tried to do the same about him. Get at his truth in a new documentary film. It's called Arthur Miller Writer. She spent 20 years interviewing her father and gathering footage, and her movie is out this week on HBO. Rebecca Miller joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So that 20 years was off and on, right? It wasn't 20 years straight gathering the material?
Yeah, no, not 20 years straight, but off and on.
So you must have had so much material.
I did. I had over 200 hours of film by the time we went to cut it together.
And you said you wanted to make this movie because your dad's public persona was so different from the man that you knew as your dad. And you felt that he was pretty much, or you were pretty much, you and his wife and I guess some close friends were the only people he could be himself with. What was the difference between who he was publicly and privately?
Well, I think everybody has somewhat of a different public and private persona, but I think in his case, partly because he'd had so much practice with interviews and partly because I think he felt a little protective of himself. He was a shy person. He had a kind of a austerity and a distance, and he was hyper-intellectual. And in our surroundings, he was just very funny and very warm and very quick-witted and, you know, really sort of just dressed out of the hardware store, basically, and kind of always working in his wood shop or making things. And it was just a different person, very, very, I want to say kind of ordinary person, but very funny. And there, he was like a working person at home.
But he also was a celebrity, and he was a celebrity, you know, after his Death of a Salesman came out and to rave reviews when it premiered in 1949. It was an instant smash success. And I just want to play a clip of tape of him speaking about how that success affected him.
With a success like that, you get feelings of omnipotence, a little touch of it, you know. You think you can do anything. Mm. You inevitably begin to feel a kind of impact of power, which is sexual, it is financial, it is everything. You begin to shift and change if you're not careful, which I wasn't. People now were talking to me differently. Women, men, they were looking at me like an icon of some kind.
So looking at him as an icon of some kind, what did that do to him personally? He was married to Mary Slattery, the mother of your half-brother and sister, and then he broke up with her. Can you talk about how his success in the theater world and in American life affected his personal relationship with her and with his family?
I think there was a sense that they weren't entirely right for each other in certain ways. That both, on the one hand, Mary, I think, had been very, very important in the creation of his early plays in that she gave him very honest feedback and was a very, very astute literary critic and observer. And I think she really supported him both financially and sort of morally in the early days when he was really struggling. But I think also he felt completely overwhelmed and unprepared for the level of success that happened to him. And of course, Marilyn happened as well. And the enormity of that wave was that she represented, it just was too much. And Mary Slattery and he got divorced and he subsequently married
Marilyn Monroe. And he wrote The Misfits for her, right? The movie, her last movie.
Yeah. He did, yeah. I think it was a gift for her, as he says in the film. Like, she always wanted to be taken seriously as an actress, and he really created that part for her.
Did he take her seriously? Did he take her seriously as an intellectual equal or as an equal?
I think he did, actually. One of the things I think she liked is that he took her seriously, that he wanted her to be a serious actress on the stage. He had an idea that she would be on the stage, and that and The Misfits was a bid for kind of like a prestige that she hadn't had, that he felt that she deserved, definitely. I think that he felt she had an instinctive intelligence that was perhaps more valuable than book-learned intelligence. She had an honesty and an ability to be unencumbered by, I don't know, what you think you should say. She just was fresh, and it was different from what he knew and what he'd experienced in that way.
Hmm. And yet, the filming of The Misfits was a terrible experience for her, right? She was unraveling then, and she wouldn't show up on set, and they'd have to stop filming, and it seemed like she was going through really a tough time emotionally. And she was married to your father at that time, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it was their undoing, really. I mean, not just The Misfits. I think it was all, I don't think you can exactly blame The Misfits, but it was definitely the end of their relationship, which was supposed to be sort of the cementing and beginning of their relationship, really. Yeah, I think she was, what you say is true. She was unraveling. And I think it was the end of a long struggle to drive those demons away that he had also been engaged in, you know, so they parted.
Yeah. So he said he didn't really work during that period when he was married to her because he was so busy taking care of her.
Yeah. I mean, that's how he saw it. So, you know, whatever the reasons were, he definitely did not work. That's true. I mean, he didn't end up writing anything else but The Misfits. I think it was taking care of her. It was probably a very much more peripatetic life than he was used to and needed as a writer, you know. Mm-hmm. And there were all sorts of concerns regarding her career and her life and making sure she wasn't being kind of ill-used by this or that one.
And this was the time also when he was hauled up in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee and had to testify about whether or not he was a communist, and he was asked to name names and all that. And that was when he was married to Marilyn Monroe.
That's right, yeah.
And so he was brought up in front of the committee. What happened?
Well, he talks about how the committee was then on sort of on the downslope and people were losing interest in it, and they needed an injection of publicity. And his marriage to Marilyn was actually probably the reason he was brought up before the committee, because they wanted a shot in the arm, and they brought him in. And he was actually sentenced to a year in prison, which was commuted because he wouldn't name names. He wouldn't talk about the other people that he'd seen at Communist Party meetings, which was a sort of bizarre ritual anyway, because for the most part, they had these names. It was a very strange moment in our history, but it was serious. People's lives got ruined.
Yeah, including Ilya Kazan, who did name names, but then I guess he never recovered from that in the, you know, in the artistic community.
Right. He decided that it's something he had to do to save, I think, his film career. And as Dad says in the documentary, you know, he never blamed Kazan. He blamed the committee, mm-hmm. you know. And that's the thing, is that to put someone in that kind of position where it's, you know, their livelihood and their passion and the thing that they've done, lived their whole life to do, it puts people in a terrible position.
So your dad was really good friends with Ilya Kazan. He directed
yeah.
a number of his plays. And so after Kazan decided to name names, what happened to their friendship?
I think it basically ended. Although Kazan did direct After the Fall, which was the next play, and the play that came out shortly after Marilyn died, that play, he did direct it. But I don't think the friendship really recovered. I think the realization dawned obviously on Dad that if they had been in the same meetings, Kazan would have given his name. And that just was the end for him.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Rebecca Miller about her dad, the playwright Arthur Miller. She has a new documentary out on HBO. It's called Arthur Miller, Writer. Well, after Marilyn Monroe died, your dad married Inga Marath, who's your mom, the photographer. And so that seemed to be at last a happy marriage. They were together for many, many decades.
They were together for many, many decades. Yeah, and I think it was. I think it was for both of them a happy marriage.
But you do ask your dad about what makes a good father, and I just want to play a clip of tape of his answer.
I think we create, especially the children, create these definitions because they have to. They're helpless. So they create the definition of this great force which can sweep them away or comfort them. And it's got sometimes very little to do with what the great force is feeling. I enjoyed being father. I enjoyed also escaping being a father.
So really honest there.
For sure, yeah.
What do you think makes a good father? Do you think your dad lived up to that definition?
Well, I can only really say my experience. For me, he was very present. And so I got to spend an enormous amount of time with him. We had a lot of very nice conversations about writing and about just life. And when he was, especially when he was woodworking, when he was in his wood shop.
So you felt like he was a good father to you?
To me, I think he was a very good father. But I also think that, you know, my older siblings grew up in a different period of his life when he was starting to make himself and go out onto the world. And in the time that they had with him was more when they would catch him when he had time.
Yeah. Well, Death of a Salesman, he seems very concerned with the role of the father in the family and how that affects the children. And
yeah.
So when you talk to him about that and how it sort of played out in his own life, what did he say?
He very much filtered conflict and stuff through the plays. So he was not a person who sought after conflict at all. In fact, he avoided conflict. And yet his plays are always filled with conflict and are centered on conflict, especially between, you know, the father and the son. And yet, as he says in the documentary, he and his own father never had an argument. They never came to any kind of fruitful conflict, because I think that he was afraid of conflict in some way, and yet craved the release of conflict. And I think that was the impetus behind a lot of the writing. I also think that, you know, seeing his father humiliated as he was when he lost all his money and went from being a successful businessman to somebody who couldn't get a job and couldn't feed his family and couldn't provide for anybody was really devastating for dad as a young man. And I think that the pathos of especially Willie Loman, even though the character himself is not based on his father at all in terms of how he is and his characterization, but there's something about the pathos of that character that I think comes from very deep inside his psyche.
Hmm. Filmmaker Rebecca Miller, her new movie is called Arthur Miller Writer. It's a documentary. It's on HBO this week. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Coming up, the rebellion in Orange County to a plan to house the homeless temporarily. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In Orange County, people are rebelling against a plan to house the homeless there. Supervisors have voted to spend more than $70 million on permanent housing for the homeless and on temporary shelters. Big tents in the cities of Huntington Beach, Irvine, and Laguna Niguel. Well, last night in Laguna Niguel, people were not having it.
Hey, ship them out to San Nicolas Island. There's an island out there that can take all of them. Let them go out there and fend for themselves.
Okay, one of several hundred people who gathered outside the Laguna Niguel City Council chambers last night. The Huntington Beach City Council is considering legal action against the county. And over in Irvine, the City Council has already voted unanimously to sue the county. Ann Doe covers Orange County for the LA Times. She joins me now. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, well, let's begin with this county plan. Tell us more about these temporary shelters, these tents.
Well, the county owns land in all three of those cities, and one idea is to put up pop-up tents that would house multiple people. There's nothing that's been decided, absolutely. But, you know, word has spread that they're eyeing the sites where the county already has the land. And, you know, of course, residents are panicking.
They're panicking? Why are they panicking?
Because it's a NIMBY issue all over again. No one wants it near them, even though specifically in Irvine, the site is not near any residential neighborhood. It's near an OCTA bus base and the Second Harvest Food Bank.
Okay, let me play a clip of tape from the Orange County supervisor who represents Irvine. His name is Todd Spitzer, and he was the only one, the only county supervisor who voted against the plan, and he actually urged the city of Irvine to sue the county.
Now we're going to take the problem and we're going to push it into your cities. And that's completely inappropriate. It scares me to death, and it's just plain wrong.
Okay, just plain wrong. What does he mean by that?
I've interviewed Todd Spitzer, and he does not want any of these temporary camps in the area that he represents. And he believes, as many of the county officials believe, that there are other spaces around OC, recuperative beds, armories, shelters, the courtyard in downtown Santa Ana, the bridges at Kramer Place, which is the first county 24-hour emergency shelter that's in Anaheim. He believes that there are enough spaces in some of those places.
And so what do the other supervisors say?
The person I talked to last night was Sean Nelson, and he says that the county is obligated to step up. We only have a short list of space that the county owns land. And the federal judge overseeing the removal of the homeless from the riverbed says you have to provide space for these people and do it in a compassionate, humane way. So the advocates that are suing to provide those spaces and to treat people in a compassionate way say you've already removed them from the riverbed. Where are folks going to go after they come out of the motels?
Right. So they were temporarily housed in these motels. How many people are we talking about here?
Just over 700.
So 700 divided up in these three cities.
It's not very clear because for people who have mental health issues and who have physical disabilities, they most likely will go to specific shelters set up for their needs.
So, but we're talking about like a couple hundred people roughly in each city.
It could be that, but nothing has been decided. This is in a very preliminary stage. Mm-hmm. But of course, word has spread on social media and people say that they're mobilizing.
So if they're saying, look, we don't want them in our city, they're saying it's not our problem that they're not from here. Is that what they're saying? So we don't want them to be temporarily housed here?
The feedback to our stories include people from OC who say, if the specific homeless person is from Orange County, then OC should step up to take care of them. If they're from LA or out of state, then leave it to those other areas. That's what we're hearing.
Hmm. Is there any way to know if the homeless are from OC or not?
There was a census done by CityNet, an agency that the county contracts to provide services to the homeless. And it shows that there's a significant number from OC, from elsewhere in California, and out of state. So it's a totally mixed population.
Okay, so the county has been ordered by this federal judge to do something. So what happens if they don't? I mean, what happens if they can't find a place to temporarily house the homeless?
Well, after many months, Orange County supervisors have pledged to solve this problem. And all five unanimously believe that the county can solve the problem. The specific locations are what's under debate right now.
Ann Doak, covering Orange County News for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
And that's it for us here at Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.